Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope for our next batch of Conversations Cafe content from Hope for the Day's Conversation Summit 2019. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. I want to thank all of our listeners for the amazing response we've had to our Wednesday episode this week with guest Amanda Vetrano. Definitely give it a listen, as it's been great to hear all the positive feedback from it so far. It was an awesome experience to record at Untold Stories Recordings for our interview with Amanda, and as you already know, they worked hard to polish up the panel content we are about to bring you today with some post-production magic as well. Be sure to check them out on Facebook and Instagram at Untold Stories Recordings for all your local audio and studio needs. We were able to save much of the audio here that was a problem with some in-house issues during the live event. However, it ends up getting much better around the 6 to 7 minute mark. So if you want to hear the intro and some of the introductions from Carl and a few of the guests, you can feel free to listen in, but just be mindful that it does get better. If not, you can fast forward to about 6 or 7 minutes into the episode and you'll be right on schedule. Another quick preview today for our upcoming season 3 content beyond our regular weekly Wednesday episodes. Starting fresh for this season, we will be starting a blog on the Anthologies of Hope website and bringing you some blog posts from past guests and friends of the show. That will be kicking off sometime in the next few weeks with the initial blog series titled Eureka, based on inspiration from one of my favorite Comic-Con artists, Monkey Minion Press, and their excellent art book titled Eureka, The Art of Science. Check them out on Instagram at Monkey Minion Press and their website at monkeyminionpress.com to get a head start. Continuing the excellent Conversations Cafe content, we'll keep those episodes rolling every Friday, just like today, both from Sip of Hope Coffee Bar and Hope for the Day's Conversation Summit 2019. On the few off weeks, when there is not any Conversations Cafe content on a Friday, we will be bringing you a new episode format for this season, the Mental Health Minute episode. These shorter episodes will start hitting the airwaves on a few Fridays in November, covering practical, research-proven tips on how you can approach your mental health care delivered in a conversational and actionable approach. Starting with two separate episodes to focus on skills and techniques for anxiety and depression, respectively, these Mental Health Minute episodes will be accompanied with blog posts of their own, so you can take away concrete courses of action wherever you may need them. So now we get to today's Conversations Cafe. Traditionally, Conversations Cafe is a monthly live podcast recording at Sip of Hope Coffee Bar featuring education and open forum dialogue on the intersections of mental health within our communities on a variety of rotating topics. However, today's Conversations Cafe was recorded live from Hope for the Day's Conversation Summit held during the first Saturday in September at the UIC Forum in downtown Chicago. Today's panel topic is titled Boys Don't Cry, and focuses on confronting stigmas that compel silence on mental health matters for those that identify as male. The guest list this week includes Davey Muse, musician and lived experience advocate, Dan Carcillo, retired Chicago Blackhawk and lived experience advocate, Adam Hill, director of the Chicago Bulls Stampede Drumline, Jordan Myers, founder of Banyan Treatment Centers, and Jeremy Foster, CEO of Big Brothers Big Sister Chicago. These folks have lived through some incredible experiences, and I'm thankful we get to share their stories with you through all their frankness and authenticity. Of course, as it is a new season, we will be starting a new Spotify playlist to join with all of our long-form interviews. You can check it out right now at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, and it has all the songs associated with the first half of Season 3. You can still find Season 1 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-1-playlist, and Season 2 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-2-playlist. Every week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we will be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Detroit Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. Detroit Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help, and Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, at gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. I'm excited to jump into today's episode, the kickoff panel of the event, and our second Conversations Cafe episode of Season 3, recorded live at Conversation Summit 2019, Boys Don't Cry.
hosts, University of Illinois Chicago, the Forum. Today we have a fantastic panel coming from a diverse range of lived experiences and intersections to talk about how stigma impacts the male experience with mental health. And when we talk about men's mental health across all age ranges, we know a few baseline statistics that men have the highest rates of suicide completion in America at almost 3 times the rate of females. We know that when it comes to male health and mental health experiences, men have later stage diagnosis for the experience of mental health challenge at some point in their life. And I bring up that statistic about late stage diagnosis of clinical depression because one thing that we know for sure is that when it comes to stigma, the title of this episode, Boys Don't Cry, is really focused on the silence that stigma can induce. But there's far more than that, and we're going to talk about it today with our amazing panel. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to jump right into it by introducing our awesome field, and we're just going to start down the line and just keep zigzagging forth. So let's start right over here with Jeremy.
Carl, I just want to first thank you for putting this on. We have to do more public forum things like this, I think, because then it becomes normal to have these conversations. So thank you for putting this on and inviting the rest of us up here to talk about this. So Jeremy Foster, I'm the CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters here in Metropolitan Chicago. I've been with the organization for 12 years. Circuitous journey to get here. I'm a government cheese food stamp kid from Sioux City, Iowa, grew up in certain situations that a lot of our littles can find themselves in as well. But this is extremely important to me because the organization, I grew up in a community center in Sioux City, Iowa. I wound up running that community center. And we had a multitude of programs, but one of the programs we had was in partnership with our Suleiman Mental Health Center. So we had programs for individuals that were clinically diagnosed. But it was actually what really hit me hard and why I was excited to be invited here was we had this group of young men who would come play basketball. And one of the stud basketball players, most popular kid, I saw him a few months after we'd done that. He visibly looked and was acting differently. And so he came into my office and he was talking about he had been in a car accident, a very traumatic experience, but that he had been clinically diagnosed. Here he was 17 years old. I could see on his face how he was just trying to rationalize what was happening to him. Because here he was, this all-star kid, everything going for him, and now he's dealing with a mental illness. And I remember the conversations vividly of, yeah, I can do this on my own. I don't have to keep going to my therapy sessions. I don't have to take the medication and stuff. And it just, that was profound. Just you could see, right? You can almost feel what he was going through. And that has stayed with me. To this journey 12 years later and really double down on impacting children, especially our young men through mentoring through Big Brothers Big Sisters. And we'll get into that a little bit later on how it impacts that, but just want to share that with you.
Moving over to Daniel.
Thanks Carl and Johnny for inviting me here. It's a great panel. I'm Daniel Carcillo. I grew up and worked for me. It's been a hard journey, but it's been the last 5 months have been the best 5 months of my life, and I'll get into a little bit of that later. But for men and being in the profession that I was, it was all of my trauma. I used a lot of negative self-talk to fuel me, and I know now that it no longer serves me. Get into a little bit of that later, but I appreciate you guys inviting me here and look forward to it.
Thank you, Daniel. Jordan, you're on
up. Hello. Hi, everybody. My name is Jordan Myers, and I work for Banyan Treatment Center. I grew up in South Florida. First and foremost, I want to thank everybody here, Johnny, Dave, Christmas, Carl, the whole crew, Mike, similar. I love this organization deeply, and I believe that they are on the forefront of really tackling the stigma behind mental health and educating people on it. So I'm very proud to be here and be connected with them. But the lived experience, man. You know, everybody is here because they want to learn more about mental health, and I believe that everybody goes through some kind of adversity in their life. Mine started very young, and I was diagnosed with depression and ADD when I was 8 years old and put on medication, which then led me to pulling out my hair. There's like an actual terminology for it that I always forget the name, so I always don't say it because I always mess it up. But I got made fun of a lot, you know, and this panel is perfect for what I went through, and it almost like took getting on this panel or asked to be speaking on this panel for me to realize how much I had to bury deep down inside growing up as a kid, getting made fun of and things like that for having bald spots in my hair, being, you know, overweight or things like that, that like I was just, you know, boys will be boys, right? That's what you hear. And that led me to becoming an addict and abusing the medications I was on, as well as tons of other drugs and alcohol. And I'm thankful that since May 16th of 2014, I've been sober, and because thank you. Because of that newfound sobriety, newfound self-worth, I've been able to focus my energy on helping people and working with great organizations like Hope for the Day and all the other organizations that are here, and just combating this whole issue with everybody who just wants to help people and educate people about mental health. So really excited to be here and be on this panel.
Thank you, Jordan. Next up is Davey.
Hi, my name is Davey Muse, and for the last 15 years of my life, I've toured around the world in a punk rock band, obviously, clearly. The guy that wore the Metallica shirt next to the guy that wore the suit. I've toured in bands for 15 years, and in the last 5 years, I've been traveling to middle schools, high schools, colleges, anywhere that would really have me, and telling my story, a little bit about me. I'm a product of drug abuse and forced sex labor. I was rescued at a young age by police in foster care, up for adoption. And when you get adopted into a scenario, it doesn't really matter how normal that scenario is. You carry this like terrible stigma of what you are, where you come from, and how much of a mistake you are. You know, growing up in the, you know, going to middle school and high school, and like middle school in the 90s, high school in the early 2000s. I grew up in prime, like, guys don't talk about anything except for chicks kind of time. And I always, from a young age, was always an emotional boy and always wanted to share my feelings. And so for me, this panel's great because for the last few years, I've been kind of trying to reverse that stigma. I've made myself as hard looking as possible, but am the softest. And I like to use that as an example. But for me, my mental health struggle, you know, my entire life was always, you know, you were the weird kid. I got adopted into a poor situation. I had a great mother, but a father who walked out, and never any positive like men in my life except for the Big Brother program. So shout out for them. And, you know, music was always the thing that got me through everything that I ever did in my entire life. And it got me through high school. It got me out of high school. It got me to a point where I was going to take off, and then I fell in love with the wrong person. And all of my dreams went away, and that overwhelming sense of why does nobody want me came back. And I lived most of my early 20s from like literally like 20 years old until 24. Like in those years are just hazy. I was just depressed, suicide attempts. I was also teaching at schools at that time, lying to myself the entire time. And it wasn't until a friend interrupted a suicide attempt with a phone call and hit me just with this reality of like, the world didn't leave you. You left the world. It's still here if you want to come back. But you can't do that from a bed. You got to get out of your bed, and you got to do something about it. And it snapped, and I started this whole entire like DIY. I'm going to get in a van and tour. I was like a creepy guy who lived in his van. I like just did anything I could to be on the road, because every time I was on stage with a microphone, I felt like myself again. And I ended up working hard enough, getting into a band called Vanna and touring around the world. The problem was when I got into Vanna, I developed this fear of anyone knowing the real me, knowing I was a poor adopted kid with mental health issues and struggled with my identity and depression and anxiety. So I just put a mask on and wrote a bunch of concept records and got on stage and tried to act like the person that you wanted me to be. I would stand back on our merch table and I would take selfies and sign stuff, and I'd get back in our van or bus and cry myself to sleep, not knowing what I was doing. It wasn't until I got off my platform and got into a literal mosh pit with kids and learned their stories and actually just shut them out for once and just listen to them, to where I found that connection. It's funny because I've been doing punk rock my, but it took me traveling around the world and back again to realize that I wasn't alone in my hometown situation. So I've now kind of, the first time I ever told my story was Hope for the Day Music Saved My Life video, where Johnny and Christmas told me what they wanted to do and the vision. I was like, that's dope. And they're like, cool, sit down and do it. And I was like, what? And sharing that message, I've chased that feeling ever since, and just constantly have just dedicated my life to just sharing the rest, sharing the dark time in my life so it might be a lifer.
Thank you. So from Davey, we have...
My name is Adam Hill. I am a full-time band director from Romeoville High School. I've been teaching there for 15 years. I'm also the director of the Chicago Bulls Drumline, and I run a non-for-profit called Pi Percussion, which is an indoor percussion ensemble that we take kids from all over the Midwest. And I also teach at University of St. Francis College in Joliet. It is awesome to be on the on this panel with all these gentlemen. I'm hoping to add the insight of the full-time everyday of what goes on in those specifically high school kids' minds as far as what's going on with mental health and some of that stigma. Me myself, you know, I played sports for a while, probably up until I was 13 years old. And then when I got to high school, I decided that, you know, I wanted to be in band. And at that time, I wasn't as big as I am now, but at that time, just being a bigger black boy, I'm supposed to play football. That's what I'm supposed to do. And my friends, you know, at that time, we're like, dude, I don't understand why would you want to do that? It's band. I don't know. I want to play drums. That's the way I felt. I thought it was going to be fun. While others, you know, they talk about, well, that's, you know, lots of bad things and words and just no respect. You know, they're going to be in the NBA. They're going to be in the NFL, da, 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 you know? So you kind of go through that. You try to build up that respect for what you're doing as you go through those high school years and just doing things that aren't what people think they're supposed to be. And that sucks. You know, it just sucks that you can't just, this is my decision. This is what I want to do. It makes me happy. You don't got to look at me if you don't want to, but I'm going to do this. And then going through that and going to school for that and developing who I want to be as a musician and be able to do so many amazing things with my music as far as teaching and performing. And then realistically, I'm the only one that ends up on an NBA court or NFL field. I also did the Chicago Bears for 10 years too, and worked with the Chicago Bears and performing with them and was able to go to London with them. And I stuck with what was true to my heart and true to myself. And had to deal with a little bit of crap, you know, a little bit of, you know, lash back from those people. But I was, you know, I respected what they wanted to do, but they did not. Probably till maybe kind of when I was a senior. You know, that stigma still today. If I walk in the school and I'm wearing my rehearsal clothes for marching band, you know, sweatpants, T-shirt and a hat, you know, and a parent walks in that might not know me. Oh, are you the football coach? No, ma'am. I am the band director. And I love saying that. I love saying that because it's like, hopefully they're like, oh man, I'm not with it. Like I'm truly just looking at somebody and labeling them right off the bat. Yeah, no, I teach band. I'm a drummer. I'm a percussion director. I like electronic music and I might look like a football player, but I'm really bad at it, and I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with that. And so just, you know, once you find that kind of identity, and now being able to look at students and see the development of what's going on in the schools as far as mental health. So many great strides and so many great educational moments to, like everyone said, just listen to a student. Okay, just, Mr. Hill, I got to talk to you. Okay. And I'll just listen. And I've heard that, you know, like they said, you know, I just like that sometimes you just listen. You don't say a single word. You just shut up and listen. And if I ask a question, I'll answer. And if I don't, you just listen. Because that's all a lot of people need, you know, boys and girls alike, but especially from the men that have to just try to be what everyone else says they should be. You know, you can be whatever you want to be. And respect that. I think it's all the perspective. Okay. I love golf and I'm really bad at it, but I know it's really hard because I play it. So I respect the people that are good at it. You know, if you want to be in chess club, then you go be in chess club. You know, all those things that are not the tough stuff. Chess is hard. I don't know how to play chess. You know, so yeah, that's a little bit of me, and excited to talk through some more things with these fine gentlemen up here. Let's go.
Thank you, Adam. And this is a perfect way to sort of transition into where we want to go with this. You know, when we're going to talk about mental health and these topics, it's important to have some baselines here. And when we talk about the concept of mental health, an easy way to think of it is, if you think of your mind as a bottle of soda or a can, everyone who's here, you know, you might even like think of like putting your hand out like this, just going, like you've got a bottle of soda or something. And if you were to shake up this can or this bottle of soda and it builds up with pressure, and obviously if you try and open it right away, it could explode all over the place. But if you open it up really slowly, you know, you get that magical sound. What's that sound if you open it up real quick? Just and hopefully we call that valve out pressure. So why I talk about that is because we're saying stigma, right? Well, we define stigma as social and cultural factors that try to dictate how we express ourselves. And where I'm going with this is, I think there's two big things that we can sort of riff on here to sort of dive in, especially if we're paying attention to what each one of you talked about from your own lived experience. And when we talk about stigma, let's move beyond a buzzword here, makes me think of it this, as how it's going to impact men. I hear the word about, with stigma, compliance, and having to comply with whatever it is for manness or manliness. And we know like the drop-down menu there, we're going to talk about toxic masculinity and all the kind of stuff, but I hear about compliance. And if we think about this idea of valving out pressure whenever we're going to experience it, if we have to comply with a certain standard, how are we coping? Especially when, you know, when we talk about alternative options or self-destructive options to cope, because we know statistically men have higher rates of substance abuse in America. And unfortunately, through surveying, direct surveying from the CDC and the National Institute of Mental Health, we see that there's a strong correlation between substance abuse and unaddressed or untreated mental health. So let's just sort of riff on this about, how do you see compliance with being the man, whatever context it is, with being detrimental to mental health? You know, when we talk about stigma, and where do we go with coping? Let's just sort of run it down.
I'll set the stage just for how powerful, I guess, the stigma is, especially for my sisters in the crowd and those that are maybe watching remotely. You know, my wife is my best friend, my love of my life. Been with my wife since high school, raised three boys. But when we've had this discussion many times, you know, I don't tell her, you know, she's beautiful. I don't say these things that they're there, and I don't say them. And the reason I don't say them is, frankly, I feel less of a man when I share those things. And this is my person that I've been with for 22 years. Right? And if I can't share that, right, it just shows you how powerful it is for men just to share feelings, even with the people who, that's your ride or die for your entire life, right? That is your person. And it is hard to say that. I was even driving down today talking about it, and she was crying, laughing about it, because she's like, it's so true. We've had many of arguments over this issue of that, you know, I don't do that enough. And it is. I feel less of a man. If I've said those things. Now, I've gotten a lot better over that. But it is real. It is powerful. But then when you take it to mental health, and if, especially if you've been clinically diagnosed, now you internalize and say, oh, something is wrong with me. That's really now hard to articulate that, because then, you know, you're vulnerable, you're weak. So it's real on many levels, but it's exponentially real when it comes to mental health, because that is, and you've been in the locker room. I can only imagine, and I've done it through, you know, high school, but at that level, especially hockey, I can only imagine. So I guess maybe I'll turn that over, you know, to talk within that context.
Check, check. Yep. Here we go. That word compliant is just the, I don't know, it just doesn't sit well with me. And to your point, growing up in Canada, you know, it's the national sport there. So if you're not playing hockey, then you're not in the cool kid group. And hockey is very much it's held in a different regard than the other sports. And we're told to believe that we need to suffer for the good of the team. We need to be in pain. If we're not, you know, looking over at this guy at the end of the game, and if we're not hurting, then you don't feel good about yourself. And that was a narrative that was given to me from a very, very young age in Canada. It's fed to you subconsciously through, you know, Don Cherry, Rock'em Sock'em videos. And you think like, okay, well, if I'm not fighting something, then, I'm not a man, you know? And, for the longest time in my career, I can now look back on my whole career and really my whole life. And I've had emotional, sexual, verbal trauma throughout coming up to the NHL. And that trauma really dictated how I played the game. And I was hurting, you know, I was hurting. And when I finished the game and when I walked away from the game, I had a lot of skewed views of the world. And every situation that I went into now, when I wasn't in that professional hockey world, I was fighting somebody. I was fighting myself. I fought my anxiety my whole career. I fought my depression. And then, you know, four or five months ago, like really coming to terms with everything and saying, you know what? Yeah, I was depressed my whole career. You know, and I've won two Stanley Cups. And I've been to this pinnacle that, you know, society holds us up to. And I remember in 2015, I retired. And I didn't go to the banner raising ceremony. I didn't want to be around anybody. I was just angry, hurt, and literally dying because of my view of the world, because of, you know, I was just fighting everything and everyone because that's what I thought I had to do to be a man. And it's just not the way it is. And if I could have used, instead of anger and frustration and sadness my whole career and negative self-talk to motivate me, if I could have used love and positivity, I mean, that's what I do now. And the energy that I get and this feeling that I get when I even just say those two words, it's just, it's hard to describe, like how happy it makes you, you know? And you know, you're not waking up anymore at 8 a.m. and saying to yourself, why didn't you get up at 7? You know, you're not doing 10 squats and then saying, oh, you could have done 12. You know, now it's okay. Like I'm loving myself now. And in loving myself, I've been able to wake up. You know, so yeah, that's all I got on the stigma.
That's wonderful, man.
The word compliance sits with me in a different way. Working in the mental health field and substance abuse field, working with clinically diagnosed individuals who have severe mental health disorders, compliant is a word that's thrown around involving medication. Are you med compliant? Oh, well, we can work with this client if they're med compliant, if they stay on their medication, but if not, you know, they're a high risk to us, right? And that's something that I dealt with growing up. Like I said earlier, you know, at 8 years old, being diagnosed with depression and ADD and being put on medication and switching those medications and then going and seeing my psychiatrist and talking to him for, you know, 15 minutes. And it was like, how you doing? You okay? All right. I think we're going to up your dose of this, and maybe we're going to put you on a dose of this, and, you know, and it was never talking about anything that I'm actually going through. It was just like, well, let's just try different medications. And I'm like, I don't know if it's working or not working. I'm like 12 years old, man, you know? But it was compliant, you know? And then it was like every day, you know, if I started struggling in school, my mom would be like, well, are you taking your medication? You know? And like, and that was my whole upbringing was revolved around these two diagnoses that I got when I was 8 years old. It was, if I wasn't doing well, or if I was doing well, it was because of medication, you know? And, so compliance, man, today I'm glad to not be on any kind of medication, but that's not to say that, people don't have chemical imbalances and need medication. So, then to piggyback off the stigma, like I was saying, you know, it really took like Carl sending me the itinerary and saying, hey, this is a panel you're on. And I was like, okay, I'm used to speaking to people about substance abuse and my story and everything, but I've never really talked about the stigma behind men's mental health and growing up, normal childhood, you know, the neighborhood kids were always better and faster at sports. And, you know, you always want to, men are always competing with each other. I'm not a woman, so I can't speak on their behalf, but I'm sure they do too. But I just remember my core group of friends just always competing with each other. And you and I have very similar stories. I am a large white guy, but so playing basketball wasn't in my cards, but because I can't jump. But I loved playing basketball until I got to high school and realized that that wasn't going to happen for me. And I joined band and started playing drums, and that like became my life after that too. And piggybacking off of that, it was always trying to find a new identity for myself, and fitting in with groups of people and never knowing what my true self was, until later on, after a little bit of college, I started touring the world and working for a lot of different artists, mostly in the back shadows. You know, I was the guy that was making shit go. You lose all your friends because you're never home. You don't really talk to your family, and things are going on that you're not really looped in on because you're not home. And then you come home and you got nobody. And that feeling so lonely, I had no self-worth and started using heavy drugs, because I just didn't want to think about anything at all. And it didn't take me, I didn't realize until after getting sober, and I work a 12-step program, and working this program, identifying with myself and finding my self-worth, that like all the traumas and things that I went through as a kid, you know, started coming out, working with a therapist and talking about things, and, you know, like realizing things that like stigmas behind my childhood as being a boy and just trying to fit in somewhere, mixed with my mental health disorders and being on all these different medications, that like it hindered my ability to understand who I was until I was able to get rid of all of that, you know? I feel like I'm rambling. So I'm gonna go to Davey here.
For me, I was blessed to have shout out to all the wonderful moms in the building or in your life. I had a wonderful mom who, as soon as my dad left when I was four, or immediately was like, "We're gonna go to therapy because you got a lot of stuff to unpack, and you're 4 years old." And kind of working through at a young age through therapy with, you know, coming to terms at a young age, understanding when you're like 12 years old that you are like a product of drug abuse and an accident and lots of stuff is like crazy to come to terms with. And being in family therapy, it made me in touch with all these feelings. And then I would go to school and I was already the kid that like would come home in tears because my jeans were like not cool at all. And I got made fun of it. Or like, you could tell my shoes were bought at like a secondhand store. You know what I mean? I didn't have a problem with that. I love it. It was fine for me. But I started developing like, oh, this isn't cool. Like none of this is cool. And then I would, you know, make friends in like, you know, middle school era and, you know, would be like, oh, so your parents aren't together? Like, yeah, my parents got divorced, when I was four, cause my dad's gay. And I'm like, you know, I'm adopted and fought. And you just saw kids be like, no way, dude. Like, I don't want to be your friend. The house was never the house that people came to hang out. And I learned at a young age that if I want friends, I can't talk about the stuff that's in my life that like, I'm able to talk about this in therapy and I'm encouraged to talk in my family like this. But when I go to middle school, I became the class clown. And I just learned to make fun of myself for being adopted, make fun of myself for being poor. You know what I mean? There was a joke. I used to walk around the cafeteria and ask everyone for a quarter. And by the like, in like within 15 minutes, I'd have enough money to go get a lunch. And everyone would be like, he did it again. And I'm like, I did it again. But in my head, I'm like, I am poor. I can't afford a lunch. And everyone in this school knows it. So I have to make fun of myself. And that started, like you were saying, like negative speech about yourself. This started this trend where every time I had an issue with a girlfriend, I would talk to no one about it. And I would just, you know, I'm a Virgo, so I'm just crazy in my own head anyways at all times. So I'm just basically counseling myself in my head, and none of this is okay. None of this is good. And it led to my breakdown at, you know, 21, just trying to be compliant the whole time. I was trying to be cool. I was trying to be a guy that maybe had his family life together. I was trying to be a guy that could hold down a girlfriend, and none of it, it was all falling apart behind the scenes, but I wasn't going to tell anybody because how many times, I mean, men in here and off on the stage, how many times have you heard like, don't be a wuss, man up, like those phrases, I'm sure you literally hear it like in a locker room all the time. Those phrases have created, the reason why there's men in the world that abuse women is because at a young age they were abused and they never unpacked their feeling, they never dealt with anything. So they just take it on women, they take it on their children. And the reason why we have grown men that are taking their own lives at 45 is because there was never anything for them. They just continued to live this life. They went from school to work to your family to your boys out doing, you know, drinking and doing whatever. It even got to the point where, you know, not that I necessarily have dealt with tons of substance abuse, but it got to the point of like compliance is like, I don't want to be 17 drinking in the woods. I was like a scared kid that I was going to get like arrested, but I did whatever was cool. I did whatever I was supposed to be doing as a guy. I would talk about women in the most disgusting way because I thought that was what I was supposed to do. I didn't feel like that at all. You know, I love women. I grew up with a healthy respect. I grew up with all women in my life, hardly any men. So like, you know, but I talked disgusting. I had a father who was part of the queer community. And I made gay jokes and I did all this stuff because I just thought I had to. And at a certain point, I attribute all of those traumas and those turmoils, I internalize them. So when I finally had something, you know, I dated the wrong person and they ended up getting pregnant, having a child, and I raised it with them and it wasn't mine. And when it all came crashing down, it was this everything that I've internalized my entire life. I stopped going to therapy in middle school, even though the state paid for it, and everything. Like, the reason I crashed so hard is because I internalized and just complied with everything I was supposed to be. And I fully believe that if I had a better culture of boys to grow up in and a better culture in high school and then college, if there was people like this in the positions that you are in, I believe that I wouldn't crash as hard as I did. I wouldn't have wasted 5 years of my life in my bed. And I attribute that to all of that toxic masculinity. When Johnny sent me the schedule, I was like, you're going to be on the toxic masculinity thing. That's this entire last school year. That's all I've been doing is going to schools and doing sessions. And then being like, can I do a boys session with all the boys in this school? And just trying to reassess the way that they look at women and everything else. And I'm like, I'm telling you this because I was you. I hear the jokes in the hallways. I see the pain in your eyes and I was you. You don't have to do that. And, you know, to a certain extent, and I'm sure you've seen it a little bit, there are a lot of these high school kids are, you know, you can make fun of millennials like all you want. By the way, if you're born of like 1982, you are a millennial, so welcome. But I think these kids are starting to have, at least they're a little bit more outward about their mental health, saying they don't have problems, or saying they have problems and saying they need help. And sometimes kids do say that. And a lot of times you probably see it with teachers. Teachers say, are you taking your meds? Or did you do your homework? And like, that's not even close to being the issue. So I think conversations like this and people like these men here, I wish I had something like this. So I think that, you know, it's very easy to take your trauma as a boy and bring it into your manhood. And like you said, with your wife, man, like that's your person, you know what I mean? But I understand why that makes you feel weak. It's because we've been trained at an early age that any sign of like anything is weakness. So.
Yeah, this is a good one. It makes you do things that you don't want to do. I remember breaking up with a girl in high school because I got made fun of because she was white. And so I broke up with her because, you know, the other girls, other black girls or black boys or whatever, those weren't even like my friends. Those were just like the outskirts of the school, you know. Because I didn't, you know, conform to what it was supposed to be, which what was it supposed to be? You know, what was it supposed to be? I was fine, you know, and then you realize that's your issue, not my issue. You know, I see it all the time, you know, people trying to conform to, sadly, it's the bad stuff. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why we want to conform to the bad things, because that gets respected more, or that is it's like it's something delicious that we need to conform to the things that are on the wrong side of the tracks, until something bad happens, unless you're just kind of strong and what you want. But I mean, I think a few people have said it, like, you know, you're supposed to think this way about women. You're supposed to make sure you have this many women and you should do this and do that. But the other flip side that I started thinking about is like, what if you flipped it? What if the idea of conforming was to like legit not conform, to say, okay, well, the way I'm going to think about it is, if that's the way that people want things to go, I'm going to do the exact opposite of that. And I think if we are able to think that way, that's when you get genius. I personally think, you know, as a musician and kind of an artist, like if I look at something like, okay, that's really cool. If I flipped it and did it the opposite way, or did this to it, would it make it better, or make it just more, or make it really interesting? And to not conform to what everybody is. I teach a music technology class, and one of the first things I say is, we will not song shame in this class. Okay, we will not song shame or genre shame, because if they like country and you don't, is it really hurting you? Is it really hurting you? Or vice versa. You can say, I don't like this because. But I don't want you to say, I don't like this. Why? Because I don't. No, that is not a reason. It could be because you didn't grow up with it and it's too foreign for you. Or is it because if you listen to that type of music with your friends, they're going to make fun of you. But realistically, you know, you're like, I think this song is a jam. You know, and that is true. It is so true. That little bitty thing. The type of music that you like can make you have a good time or a bad time with the people that you are with in your life. And I think that's totally ridiculous. You know, something that makes you feel good inside that you can only listen to by yourself
in your car or in your room. I remember my sisters would make fun of me. I have two younger sisters. And when I was really getting into this, listening to a bunch of different music at that time when I was in high school, Riverdance was a big thing. And I thought Riverdance was awesome. I thought it was, you know, they danced real cool. The music, I just thought it was cool. And so I'd be in my room and I'd be listening to the Riverdance soundtrack. And my sisters, you're like, what are you listening to? I'm like, this is Riverdance. What are you listening to? You know, and I listened to all the stuff, but that was something that I just found was interesting. It was a part of growth as a musician. I was listening to it for enjoyment, but it's different things that get put in your head as far as being, you know, an artist and things like that. But I remember that so vividly. They would make fun of me all the time. Oh, they're my sister. They're supposed to. It's like the gig, you know. But there was a stigma that I should not be listening to to white women and white men dancing on their toes and with I should not be doing that. But I liked it. I thought it was cool. But, you know, so think about it. I think if we bring it down to the smallest thing and accept people for what that is, as far as even just music shaming, it could probably be better if we just start at that little bitty point.
I love that, that you bring that up. And thank you, everyone, for sort of riffing on that. Because talking about the music thing, one of the things that we'll do at Hope for the Day in school sort of engagement is we'll just start with, I don't know if there's any... I don't see any, but we'll start with like just asking a group, like, what's your favorite song? And some will say something, some won't. And that's where we start the whole thing about stigma. It's like, if it's hard to talk about your favorite song among your peers, imagine what it's going to be like when you have something that's based on thoughts, feelings, and emotions inside. So this is a perfect place, you know, as we're sort of going to be winding down a little bit here. We got to make it crystal clear, right? When we talk about self-expression, how we communicate our mental health is... you know, the words for our thoughts, feelings, and emotions. That's not just an intangible thing. Self-expression is dancing, singing, and painting and those things, but it's also communicating the internal experience. And if we recall back the soda bottle and the valve thing, compliance is the thing that's breeding the silence. So if you paid attention to what each one of them were describing, each one of these gentlemen explained what they were trying to comply with, but in trying to go along with that, you're not addressing your mental health. And it may start with an emotional discomfort that's a small pressure on you today, but it could also be a sign or symptom of something that's going to progress into something far more destructive to your life. The term or the name of this episode, Boys Don't Cry, is not an accident. In our work, we see anywhere you go, it can be Brothers Don't Cry. German men don't cry. Real Irish men don't cry. Real Mexican men don't cry. Real Indian men don't cry. Real South Korean men don't cry. Real Japanese men don't cry. Real Nigerian men don't cry. Real South African men don't cry. Real Russian men don't cry. Everyone and the mother thinks they got an ownership on this quality of self-expression. And in that, we're creating a silence. And silence is the biggest obstacle to effective suicide prevention and mental health. And drug use and turning to drug use. And when we talk about Boys Don't Cry, for instance, a big scenario we can put through in any school, for instance, or any hallway, is you got a kid who identifies as male crying in that hallway. That's going to be a story at lunch. You're going to be like, oh, did you see so-and-so? You take a kid, walk out of classroom, and hit a locker. It's nothing, right? It's no big deal. The implications are massive. And there's a lot of intersections, but even when we talk about things up to public mass shooting violence, we're talking about a lot of underaddressed or untreated mental health challenges or things that are ignored. And now that's an extreme part of the spectrum, but just for our basic health. So I think as we're wrapping down here, what would be important is, all right, stigma can try and control us and keep us silent. What are some tools we found? And you've sort of touched on this a little bit, but I think it's important to just drive this right down on the head, right on the nose, pardon me, about what are tools you think both young men, adult men, any age, anyone who identifies as male can embrace to combat that stigma, to take care of their own mental health. And I'm going to just flip the script a little bit. We're going to go back this way around. So just kick it over to Adam.
I think being able to talk to someone is huge. It can either be someone that just can just sit there and listen, or that you know has gone through that experience and that can give you legitimate feedback. Because that's sometimes that's really all that it is that it sits in here for weeks and months and whatever long, and you've never like put it out for someone else to hear. Which sometimes I'm sure everyone in this room has, like, you've started talking to yourself. You're sitting in your room, you're sitting somewhere like, oh yeah, I should do that. And then, okay, what if I do that? And then before you know it, you figured the whole thing out just because you said it out loud, or you're telling someone an idea or story. You're like, you know what? Never mind. I just heard it come out of my mouth and I know exactly what I'm supposed to do now. And I think that exercise is really healthy. The hard part of doing that is to actually do it. You know, I could have a hard time bringing up something with my wife. I could have a hard time bringing up something with my best friend, you know, because it's not that. And the thing about it, you know, when I think about it, are any of those people going to judge me? No, not at all. Not at all. Like, I could probably do that with any of these people up here, and there would be literally no judgment. But it's the fact that to open your mouth and let the things fall out can sometimes be hard. Like, I've had moments where I'm like, okay, I need to talk about something. And I feel like it's like when you're watching that movie and the person is practicing it in their head, and you just see them sitting there and you hear the dialogue in their head, like how they're going to do it. Hey, how you doing? Hey, how are you doing? I mean, what, like, you know, you're going through that before you say what you need to say. And then you've like, you take a deep breath. Like, I've almost like counted myself off before. 1, 2, 3. And then still nothing comes out, like, to like get it out. So, you know, if you have someone that you know will listen and either not say anything back or just say, you know what, it's cool, man. How about we try this? I think that's huge. But you have to know. But I think it's also important for the people on the other side, just in common conversation, to be able to say, hey, you know what? If you ever need something or you need to talk, man, just let me know. Like, I'm 100% here. 100% here. My wife said, you know, if I go out with some of my guys and she'll go out with some of their girls, like, you know, yeah, we talk. She won't tell me what they talked about. Like, but you know, we talk about some deep stuff. And they're like, so what'd you guys talk about? Drums. And she's like, are you kidding me? You didn't talk about like this or that? No, we didn't. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, she's totally right. Like, why are we not? Like, I know there's stuff. I know there's stuff. You know, I know there's something that either I want to share. We get into this mode of just like talking shop, so to say, because it's fun and it makes us feel good. We can talk about the good shop and the bad shop, but we might not talk about the good life and the bad life. You know, that's such a bummer. It's really such a bummer. And so I find myself sometimes I'll try to like creep a thing in. You know, well, you know, how are you and so and da 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 da. You know, what's going on with that? And that might float the thing. We might, even if it's complaining, good. Complain. You know, yeah, my wife is driving me nuts because such and such and such and such. And my kids, I just want them, I don't know, I want to send them to the moon. You know, and because that's all real stuff. You know, I got two little boys and they're awesome, 6 and 4. But man, the argument that I had with my son before I walked out of the house today was I did not cut his apples thin enough. Bro! You're not, but this is what I said. You're not going to cry about how thin your apples are. I thought that was legitimate, though. I mean, it's apples, right? I don't know. But then I started double thinking myself. I was like, well, I'm about to go to this panel. But I was like, they're apples, you know. But to him, as a 4-year-old or a six-year-old, maybe that's important. So and you have to like check yourself at that time. That's what I got.
I like to look at, someone asked me, I think I was doing the photo thing over there, and I like to look at myself as for years I was just pouring gasoline all over myself. I built myself a big stage and I just sat there covered in gasoline for years. And like, there's only one thing left to do, and that's to light yourself on fire. I just, for me, being a living example, talking about it, doing these videos, doing these panels, it's cathartic for me because I get to work through, not only work through my issues, but I got to meet, we were up till 3 a.m. talking about our stories. Like, and I went to bed feeling so good that I connected with another person, that there's someone out there that, you know, I now can reach out to. My biggest thing that I try to push to kids is that, you know, you can build your platforms as high as you want. You can, you know, you could, you know, cover yourself in gasoline for years, but it comes to that point where you have to do something. You got to set yourself on fire and be this example. So I guess my challenge always is the thing that worked for me is talk about your stories, talk about your scars, own them, be proud of them. Don't be ashamed. I cut myself for years. I tried to commit suicide. You know, I was an addict. Don't be ashamed of that stuff. That's your journey. And the more that you embrace that journey, the more that you embrace those scars, the more that you're able to share those with other people, and they can, you know, I physically have some scars from trauma, and you'd be amazed how many times I go to a school and I talk about my scar. And then after I'm done, kids come up to me and they show me their scars. And right away, they decided at a certain point that I was on this stage, and I'm going into schools at like 7:45 a.m. So, you know, ain't no one trying to hear anything from anyone. And then it's just me in a gymnasium. I'm like, hey y'all, what's up? The biggest thing for me is that we all have these stories and we all have these scars, and you're walking around and you're liking each other's Instagram posts and you're sharing stuff on Facebook. When's the last time you looked at your homie and you were like, are you good? Are you okay? Because I'm not okay. As you know, I just went through my parents' divorce. And if you want to talk about some stuff, I'm down to hear that. You know what I mean? Setting yourself on fire and being the burning example, you know, you led your life in addiction. So now you are living the rest of your life set on fire to help other people, being a guiding light for other people, you know, making it our life's work. I think for all of us is pretty much like definitely how we get through it every single day. I don't ever not want to be with a microphone in my hand talking about the stuff. I'll do it until I'm too old to stand on a stage, and then I'll get a wheelchair and you can wheel me on the stage. I just think it's important for us to continue to talk about us and use yourself, and don't ever be the hero of your own story. Use yourself as the burning example of what they don't need to go through.
Definitely going to piggyback off of what these two gentlemen just said, but don't ever come up to me and ask how I'm doing if you're looking for the typical answer of good, how are you? And then just walking away, because the way I live today, I will tell you every goddamn thing that's going on in my life. Hey, how are you? Well, my kid won't stop crying. I don't know why. He's at this age. He's like screaming for no reason. You know, mom's got cancer and she's super negative. My wife is an empath, so every time I come to her, because she's my best friend and I want to tell her what's going on in my life, she's just like, well, yeah, I feel that. And I'm just like, you know, and then that person's like, okay, dude, well, see ya. Yeah. So that's how I live my life today. I have to be an open book, because if I'm not, then I get trapped in the misery. I get trapped in I call it future tripping, or I call it living in the past. You know, I'm just not living in the present. Someone once told me that, like, I can't remember what specifically happened, but it was like a terrorist attack that happened in Paris, and somebody that I was acquainted with passed away in that terrorist attack. And I was losing my mind about it. I was like reading the Quran, and I'm like, oh, why do these people do this? And, you know, just like all in my head, like, oh, I'm gonna buy guns and join the army. And like, you know, I'm talking to my friend, and he's like, Jordan, what are you doing tomorrow? And I was like, I'm going to work. He's like, no, you're not. I'm like, what do you mean? Yeah, I got work tomorrow. He's like, no, you know why? Because tomorrow doesn't exist. He's like, you know, what are you doing right now? And I'm like, I'm driving in the car talking to you. And he's like, you could die right now. And I'm like, wow, well, thanks, man. but it hit me. And I was like, you know what? You're right, man. He's like, so why are you thinking about all this shit that you can't control? And I was like, you're right. And then he's like, what'd you do yesterday? And I started like telling him what I did that day. And he stops me and he's like, it doesn't matter. I'm like, why? And he's like, because nothing's ever going to change from it. It already happened. Move on. What are you doing in this moment, in this very moment in time? And so when I'm not an open book and I'm not talking about the things that are going on in my life constantly with all of my support systems, my 12-step program, my peers at work, my wife, you know, all of these things, I get stuck in those modes and it's hard for me to realize that like the only thing I have control over is my two hands and my two feet and talking to you guys right now, right? One thing, you know, that I'm going to touch on that works for me may not work for everybody and some people are uncomfortable with it, but like I believe in God. I'm not religious. I don't tie it to religion, but I'm very spiritual. And I believe that all of you are God. The weather outside is God. The cars on the road are God. The trees blowing in the wind. Everything is God except for me and what I'm doing in this moment in time. And that's all I ever have any kind of control over at any moment in time. Another tool that I use is I see a therapist. Sometimes you talk about it with people for sure. But sometimes, like I was just saying, you know, my mom's going through her own stuff. She can't talk and she's usually my rock. And my wife is an empath. And like the people that are close to you aren't always the best people to talk to you about what's going on. Sometimes you need an unbiased opinion and you need to go see a therapist, and there's resources everywhere. And you are sitting in a room full of people and an organization that will point you in the direction of all of those resources. But talking is what you need to do. You like everything, you know, that's so in my daily life today, I have to be an open book. The only way that I could, like Davey was saying, the only way I could stay on my winning streak and having this like newfound like grasp of life, setting myself on fire is to give that away. I can only stay on my winning streak by giving people their winning streak. When I'm up on stage or doing things and I'm talking to people about addiction or sharing my story and going through all that, I'm not doing that for them. I'm doing that for me. I have to do that in order for me to stay sober. I have to do that for me to be reminded of where I came from and how far I've gotten to. So be an open book, you know, and find the people you can talk to. And if you feel like you have nobody to talk to, find a therapist. And if you think that therapist isn't the right one, find another therapist. There will be somebody for you to talk to. Just talk. That's the greatest tool that I have is this mouth. Thanks.
Oh, all right. That's great, boys. So we talk a lot about who we're going to talk to, and for me, I've been through Moxa acupuncture, cranial sacral, functional neurology, just a whole slew of treatments to try to figure out what's going on with my brain and my brain chemistry and why I have these thoughts that I have. And until I went internally and changed what I'm naturally creating as far as my hormones in my body and my pituitary gland and my thyroid. And then in doing that, I've been able to change how I talk to myself. So the biggest thing that I've that has helped me is obviously staying connected to others and asking for help when I needed it. And the last 5 months is just changing that narrative about myself. It's not negative anymore. It's positive. And I'm just getting it's just such a change in energy, and it's such a change in who I'm attracting into my life, because I'm attracting people that are now like-minded and, that believe in the same things that I believe in. And, you know, these three gentlemen have touched upon it. Like, we are all energy. We are all connected. And if we stayed in this room without water for 7 days, then we all die of dehydration, you know? And that's what I believe. And I believe that my higher power has put me through this suffering, and I feel like I've been in this world before, and that I have this warrior spirit. I needed to suffer and go through all of this pain to learn about myself and learn about my brain, and then learn that, you know, that negative self-talk just does not serve me anymore. And if I'm going into anything I do in my life with my cortisol levels through the roof, which is the stress hormone, then how am I treating people? And what's going on with my brain chemistry? Because I viewed the world like everybody's out to get me. I'm going to fight you. I don't flight. I fight. And I'll stand right here. And even if we're having a good conversation, I'm thinking in my head, when am I going to get effed over? And that's just not a way to live our life, because what do we all want in this room? I mean, I know what I want. I want to be free of suffering and pain, and I want to love. And now when I think of that, I can see the joy in my kids. I have a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 1-year-old. And to your Apple story, it's like I have to tell myself, well, why get mad at him for just wanting something so simple? And he just wants a simple thing. Well, why can't I act like that? I want these simple things. Just want to be free of suffering and pain, and I want to be happy. You know, and how do you get there? And the negative self-talk is not serving me. And then to everybody's point, yes, speak up, talk to somebody. You can't talk to somebody, write it down on a piece of paper, talk to yourself, burn it. You know, there's always something that you can do, and don't give up hope, because there's always other treatments, you know. That's what I have. So, and then if I say this and it's like, you know, 5 months ago, I used to get angry at people that say this, you know, if something's sparking in you and I say that you need to love yourself, you need to change, you know, because there's still a part of me that's like, what are you talking about? You know, the other day I caught myself giving myself a pat on the back. First time. I can't remember one. And I was like, oh, I'm like, where the fuck did that just come from? Who just said that? You know, and it was an unconscious voice. But I was totally conscious. Like, I was in the moment around a whole bunch of life, plants that I'm growing. And it was just amazing. So, like Lil Wayne said, love yourself. You know?
Well, thank you for starting the opposite way, because there's a reoccurring theme that actually is a great segue into Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Big Brothers, Big Sisters is about creating and sustaining life-changing relationships, and we use one-to-one mentoring to do that. You need somebody to talk to, right? Men need men. Create are incredibly powerful, because it allows a young man to have this non-threatening conversation with another man who's not going to judge you, who's in your corner. They're not a parent, so they're not an authority figure. They're just that person that consistently is there in your life to listen, and then can expose you to different situations that make you feel good. So I'm going to touch on some of what Daniel was talking about feeling good and how powerful that is, because doing good is extremely powerful. But I got to tell you that the star of today for me was actually Davey. And if it's okay that I share a little bit, Davey. Yeah. I walked in the green room. Davey sees the B. I'm always representing the organization. He's like, Big Brothers, Big Sisters? I said, yeah. Davey said, I'm a product of your organization. And then he continues to explain to me how his big brother had profoundly impacted his life. And I know, Davey, maybe you want to talk maybe a little bit, if you can, about that?
Cry on this Boys Don't Cry panel. We contacted I grew up with a single mother, and we contacted Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And my sister got a big sister, and I got a big brother, and he was arguably the coolest dude I've ever met in my entire life. He was like 22 years old, 23 years old, just graduated college. He worked at 9X Mobile, which literally became Verizon. He had like a car phone. He listened to the Mighty Mighty Boston's and Beastie Boys and punk rock. He brought me to my second Warped Tour ever. Being old enough and being like 12, 13 years old, you realize that this person doesn't have to be spending their time with you, and they are. And for me, having no men in my life whatsoever, this guy's name's AJ, literally changed the trajectory of like my life. He's like, you like music? Me too. Like, why don't you do that? You want to go to shows? Let's go to shows. Like, it was a cool guy that wasn't my mom that I could go to concerts with. You know what I mean? Because my mom would be willing to bring me to anything, but I'm like, I don't want to go to anything with you, mom. Are you kidding me? And it was this cool dude that just invested in me for literally no reason at all. and it definitely changed the trajectory of my life. He was the only male influence I had until my mom got remarried and I was later in my 20s, and definitely I'm a living proof of his organization and what it can really, the power it really has.
Thank you, Davey. And why that's powerful too is the fact that he even came up and shared that, right? Because sometimes it's, well, what, you were in Big Brothers Big Sisters, you know, well, what was wrong with you, right? Right, it's a stigma. It's a stigma, right? And the fact that he came up right away and he let—I was actually, you know, tearing up, crying. I had to give him a big man hug in there because, you know, that I can't. You know, he's a living testament of it, and he can definitely tell you more about it. But this sense of doing good and feeling good, Daniel nailed it, right? You start talking about yourself, and that positive energy is so incredibly powerful. And I had a big brother telling a story. His little was actually—he got in trouble at school because he was bullying. Right? He was looking for an outlet. He's like, I got to do something that makes him feel good, that's doing good. Went to McDonald's. The big brother bought 100 cheeseburgers. And the little brother's like, wow, man, we're about ready to get our eat on, right? He's like getting excited. He's like, no, that's not for us. So they go to a shelter, and he's like, no, I want you to go talk to people and start passing that out, right? It was that moment, right? Didn't get in trouble in school, stopped bullying. He felt what it's like to do something good for somebody else, and how powerful that was. Instead of beating somebody up, you did good for him. That kid now does well in school. He stays out of fights, you know. So these relationships are incredibly, incredibly powerful. Men need to talk to men. And it's not that, you know, women are not powerful in our men's lives, because actually our greatest partner is our moms and our grandmas who come to us, who are working multiple jobs and have reached out and said, partner with us to do this. But have said, just to your point, I don't want to go to a concert with you. I don't want to talk about these things with you, because it's kind of odd to do that, right? So I just, again, thank you for coming up here to share all the different perspectives and how powerful this is, and just getting it out there in the open has been incredibly meaningful for me personally. Thank you.
Thank you. So as we wind down this episode, the big takeaways that we want you to pay attention to is the importance. Stigma impacts everyone. There's no prejudice for mental health. And we know that. We're going to hear more panels about different intersections. But when it comes to those who identify as male, starting the conversation we're not having is a super powerful tool, and it can be achieved through peer-to-peer. If you are someone who's listening here, you can be that voice that starts a conversation with someone you know. You can also help empower that conversation, regardless of your gender. Next step up, when we talk about this idea of compliance with masculinity and all that kind of stuff, toxic masculinity ultimately is unchecked, healthy mental health. Toxic masculinity and all the drop-down menus from it persists when people aren't learning how to love themselves and aren't learning how to respect the dignity of other individuals. We have all these hostile endpoints because we also see it in self-destructive behavior. We also see it, whether it's self-destructive thoughts or actual physical external behaviors. So what I want you to do, especially as you re-listen to this episode over and over again, is take to heart these vastly different and diverse experiences always come down to the same thing. The name of the game is starting the conversation. The name of the game is recognizing that it's okay not to be okay. If you can take that to heart, and especially for those who are with us live, if you can take that conversation with you here, and don't let it stop here, but bring it with you out into your community and talk about, yo, I heard this cat Adam talk about how he was in band, and just because you're black doesn't mean you got to be in sports. I heard about this dude Davey and like being tatted up and coming out of that life, and like being someone who had to go into the foster system doesn't mean you're broke, and that doesn't write your script for the rest of your life. Being someone like Jordan, just because you turn to substances to cope and abuse does not mean your story begins and ends that way, or you're just an addict. Okay, there's more to that. And talking about Daniel, there's too many of us who are living with this idea of masculinity as being the hardcore jock, athletic, strong, A1. You can hurt regardless of how much you can bench press. And if you're not talking about it, it's going to run you down. That's a fact. And again, and Jeremy closing out with us, if you have the capacity, being a mentor to somebody else can change the world. So I want you to make sure to check out these guys wherever you can find them online and in their organizations. If you're interested in becoming a big brother, big sister,
drop an email contact to them, whether it's Chicago or any other agency in any other urban space, a major urban market, but there's also rural areas too as well. And check out all their information on the program suite that we've shared with all attendees. And again, Conversations Cafe, Boys Don't Cry is brought to you by FSP, Banyan Treatment Centers, and we thank you all. Give them a big hand.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.